Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
With the first pick in the 2024 NFL Draft, the Chicago Bears select Caleb Williams, quarterback, Southern California.
There he is, a Detroit cheer for Caleb Williams.
I mean, he is flying up there. He is excited to get this journey started.
When you see all the things that come with Caleb Williams, people have talked about the nail polish and the flair that he, you know, the way that he dresses, and he made so much money in NIL. I can tell you from experience, this guy has a competitive fire in his eyes. And ever since I talked with him as a true freshman when he was at Oklahoma, this is what he has been dreaming of, not only this moment, but being the number one pick. This has been his goal. He wants to go to an organization, and as he told me, change the culture. He wants to be that engine for the Chicago Bears.
Yeah, and that's how they get a couple $1 billion a year money to finance a new stadium on the lake, too. All the excitement surrounding Caleb Williams, who not only can turn the franchise around as number one overall pick and putative starting quarterback for the Bears, but also he can host a drag queen story hour at the Harold Washington Library.
Wait, what?
Nail polish.
Oh,
polishes a nail. Yeah.
No, aren't you excited? Did you watch the whole draft? I had to finally unplug at about 9 o'clock last night, but I am so excited. I even want my season tickets back. I think this is going to be good. Did you see when he won the Heisman? For some reason, I never watched the Heisman Trophy presentation.
Yeah, but 2 years ago.
Yeah, but he was so gracious, and he was so, he is a little flamboyant, but I don't care. We need that. We need a leader. We need somebody like Jim McMahon back
in
Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how you think about this 5 years from now when he turns out to be Sam Bowie to Drake May's Michael Jordan, who the Patriots picked 3 overall. I mean, you know that no matter what happens, and if they would have picked Drake May, then Caleb Williams would be the Michael Jordan. It's cursed. They're cursed, the Bears, when it comes to drafting quarterbacks. They passed on Mahomes. They passed on Deshaun Watson.
Quarterback from North Carolina, remember?
His name is Mitch Trubisky.
Mitch Trubisky.
Yeah, remember. But, of course, this is all against the backdrop of what I really want to talk about, not Caleb Williams and trying to handicap whether he's going to be a superstar in the NFL or not, because you all listening know as much about that as all these goofy, frustrated jocks and dorks who populate sports talk radio and so desperately want to be taken seriously and be members of the serious crowd at the political press corps, which is why most of them are leftist hacks. Except for the lovely Sage Steele and a few others. The real talk is, of course, the unveiling not of the first overall pick, but of the beautiful lakefront plans for a new domed Bear Stadium and retrofitting the old Soldier Field Stadium into 14 acres of public green space.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Well, the GM of the Bears, Dan, says that there is money there. I don't know if we know this as Chicagoans, as taxpayers.
There are dollars that we believe exists at the state level, at the potentially federal level, potentially at the city level.
Isn't he cute?
Was that Ryan Poles or Kevin Warren?
No, that's Kevin Warren.
Well, Kevin Warren's not the GM.
Ryan Poles is.
Kevin Warren is the new Ted Phillips.
Right.
Kevin Warren is running around polishing Jelly Belly's apple and talking about his great working relationship with the politicians, these great leaders we have, his words, great leader, J.B. Pritzker, great leader. And, you know, that they've got this thing sketched out in phases. So, for example, in phase three, if you can't come up with enough cash for the hotel, then maybe we can scrap the hotel. But as long as we get that upfront cash that we need now so we can continue playing on the lakefront, not have to go to Champaign again, and, you know, get what we want from the city, state, whoever, just other people's money, then, you know, we can work something out. I still don't understand how this makes economic sense to the McCaskies.
I don't either. I mean, they're still the largest landowners in Arlington Heights, 326 acres. Probably, obviously, they're going to sell that because they're not going to be using it.
Well, there's nothing obvious about it. We don't know yet. This is my point. This doesn't make sense. Now, maybe this is a real play, and they're just willing to forego the increased value in the franchise by building a Bearsville in Arlington Heights, where they own the land and they own the stadium, for another 40-year lease with the park district in the city, and the litigation costs with Friends of the Park. So, and the limitations you have on space, that you can't build a multi-purpose environment there the way that you could in the old Arlington Park site. It just makes no economic sense. So maybe out of our civic duty, we're going to keep it on the lakefront, or politics is playing some role. Or maybe this is just putting a good face on, we explored every option. We tried to keep it in Chicago. We tried to do it on the lakefront, but Friends in the Park and the lack of financing, I don't think actually that's going to be a problem, I'll get to. But maybe Friends of the Park and so on and so forth got in the way. So now we've got to go to Arlington Heights, and this is just a PR operation. But it doesn't feel like a PR operation to me. It feels like Kevin Warren is serious about trying to get this done on the lake, and I just don't get it because it makes zero, I'll say for the third time, it makes zero economic sense.
Well, I watched their press conference, Ivan. Somebody asked him, why would you want to rent again from a publicly owned stadium, renting when you own the land already? And this is what he said. He said, we're going to be fair with each other and work out fair terms.
I don't know what that means.
I don't know what that means, but that was his name. I wrote it. I'm listening going, what does that mean? Like, why isn't the reporter saying, well, what does that mean? He just thinks that this, you know,
well, that's the same version of, that's a different version of what I just said. How does this make economic sense from the perspective of the McCaskey family, the owner, the majority owners of the Bears? You can't make it make sense. You can't. But, I mean, I get it. He's got great leaders in Chicago and Illinois that are huge sports fans.
Incredible legends, Dick Butkus and Mike Ditka.
Mike Ditka. Maybe Brandon John, maybe I tell you what. Maybe what Kevin Warren should do is fly Brandon Johnson down to Naples so that he can meet Mike Ditka. And maybe that will, sweeten the deal for him or seal the deal. $2.5 billion is what they want in taxpayer funds. I know, and it's been reported. We have to look at this, Jelly Belly. We have to look at this in the context of our priorities. I don't know if this is the highest priority for taxpayers. You understand that that's just public posturing.
Oh no,
public posturing by all of them.
He wasn't even invited to the announcement the other day. They did not invite Governor Pritzker.
Well, so what? So that doesn't mean anything.
Well, they need state funds, so you think that you'd invite them. I don't know.
I don't think you're picking up what I'm putting down. It is public posturing by J.B. Pritzker to express skepticism.
Right.
So that 6 months from now, at the end of, well, not even, at the end of session before they leave in June, they could say, I was skeptical, but we sat around the table. We did the work. We negotiated, and I think we achieved a compromise that's in the best interest of the residents of Illinois as well as the Bears to make this great stadium and keep the Bears in the city and blah, 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 and live up to Daniel Burnham's promise of blah, blah, to make no small plans and more park space for the kiddies. And that's what they're going to do.
Well, we still owe $580 million funded by the Chicago Hotel Tax for the 2002 renovation.
Whatever.
Which Daly should have put a dome over that before, but he didn't.
And by the way, they got to get money over to Reinsdorf for the new Comiskey in South Loop too.
Well, Warren, Mr. Warren did meet with the White Sox and Jerry Reinsdorf on Sunday, last Sunday. He even said at that press conference, he's like, it'd be an incredible day in Chicago if we are able to build two stadiums at the same time. Thousands of jobs created.
Right. You're getting shined on. Mm-hmm. Does everybody get it that they're getting shined on? Oh, this is a process, and it would be a great day, and I'm remaining positive. You know, this is what he said before the state-run media ed board over at the NPR Times. I don't want to get into what if the financing doesn't come through, because I'm staying positive. I'm a positive guy. Okay, Tony Robbins. Now let's talk like dollars and cents. This is a ruse. This is all, look. We're going to do this. We got to put on a big show. We got to pretend there's some give and take and some consternation that we're not just rubber stamps for whatever professional sports teams want to extract from taxpayers. This is a big show.
Well, they say it'll be better for Chicago, a better, stronger, safer Chicago, because we'll have college and football playoffs. We'll have
stop saying they.
I'm sorry. Brandon Johnson.
What I've said from the very beginning is that an investment like this requires real skin in the game from ownership, which they've done that, a commitment to public use, which they've done that, as well as, you know, an overall commitment to, you know, building a better, stronger, safer Chicago.
Exactly. We drove a hard bargain. We drove a hard bargain. Boy, we raked them over, and we went through every detail, every line item, and we hammered out the best deal going. You're welcome, Chicago. You're welcome, Illinois. That's the play.
I know.
Jim in Crown Point.
Caleb will channel Papa Bear. He will be the next Mike Ditka. He will close the border. At the end of the season, they will be 16-0. Go Bears! Go Bears!
Right. I just love what he said, though. He said, "I can't."
Not a great super fan impersonation, by the way.
I can't wait to meet the players, get to know their names, and meet their families. I'm like, look at him. He's such a leader. I'm so excited.
Oh, my gosh.
I know I'm such a chick, and you don't like talking about sports.
I can't wait to meet the players. Oh, my gosh, I'm in love.
No.
Oh, my God, he's the greatest
ever. I want to meet the players' families.
Oh, my God.
Not the players.
Wow. Oh, my. That is Napoleonic. Okay. Churchillian.
And J.J. McCarthy went to Minnesota, the Vikings.
I don't know what the hell the Vikings are thinking.
Well, everybody looked so prepubescent, didn't they? They look so young. Like babies, little babies.
Okay, all right. Enough bear talk. You can go listen to, fat liberals on sports radio talk about the Bears if you want more of it.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Where do you want to start with the pit protesters around the country? Those are the pro-Islamist terrorist protesters. We got Ivy League, Big Ten, Pac-12.
I'm sorry. 33 arrested at IU, Indiana University.
Is that where you want to start, the Big Ten?
Well, no. That's the most for the Big Ten. They started setting up an encampment at the Dunn Meadow, and they started taking it down. Then they arrested 33 people. But your school is getting a lot of attention. Northwestern. But they're still there. They haven't taken it down. But guess what's going to take it down for them, Dan? This big storm that's coming. I don't think the kiddies are going to be able to survive it, do you?
Yeah, I think they will. They're committed. Couple of things that happened yesterday at Deering Meadow on the campus of Northwestern that are noteworthy. Mm-hmm. One is that, they did one of these linking of arms, human chains deals like they did at Columbia University to repel any Jewish students that would happen into their encampment. You got to push them out. But this case, this human chain at Northwestern, was to push back on police. And push back they did, literally. Mm-hmm. And, nothing has changed at Columbia or Northwestern. They still don't have a plan to clear these autonomous zones, these encampments, these decolonization sanctuaries. Still don't have a plan. How much planning does it take to move 100 dinks from Northwestern out of a meadow? And the same goes at Columbia.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. They released statements saying that they're going to be removing students and tents, but they aren't doing it, so that's why I'm kind of confused.
One of the people that if you've seen the videos of literally a fight between protesters and police, you see people getting physical with police officers. Campus, and it looked like Evanston police to me, too, at Northwestern.
Yeah, they're there.
One of the individuals leading the fight with police has been identified as Stephen Thrasher. He's an assistant professor of journalism at Medill. Of course he is. Where do these radical, quote-unquote, journalists come from? Yeah, golly. Mm-hmm. It's a real mystery.
Kids might get extra credit if they go out there and participate.
Stephen Thrasher is the Daniel Renberg Chair of Social Justice in Reporting, with an emphasis on issues relevant to the LGBTQ community. Isn't that implied? Where else would the emphasis be? Daniel Renberg, Jewish. I mean, he's now since passed. He endowed this chair. He was a gay man who had a big wealth management practice in Beverly Hills. So, here we go again. At some point, you're going to have to start connecting the dots if you want this sort of thing to stop, if you want these sorts of people like Stephen Thrasher not to be in well-heeled sinecures at supposedly elite universities. Just a little bit of detail that nobody else will report to really drive the larger conversation. It's easy to wring your hands about the boorish behavior of these maladjusted ignoramuses on campus, both the professors as well as the students. I don't know if you saw Emory University. chairman of the philosophy department at Emory University
in Atlanta.
She was arrested by her name is Noelle McAfee. She was arrested by Atlanta police.
I'm so sorry. Is there anything I can do for you right now?
Yes. Can you call the philosophy department office and tell them I've been arrested?
Philosophy department?
Yes. Call the philosophy department office.
I will. What's your
Noelle McAfee? I'm chair of the philosophy department.
I got you.
The president-elect
of the university. I got you.
Oh my God.
I guess we have to really think about this. Is this really the job of the philosophy department? Let's think about. Let's have a thought experiment. I think you're missing the joke there. So this is what you have on campus, and this is what everybody finances. By the way. For those billionaires that were patting themselves on the back very publicly and spouting off after years of willful blindness and support of the left, Bill Ackman comes to mind. Harvard's anti-Israel tent camp soaked by sprinklers as heated protests pop up across the country. Yeah. So Harvard is being beset by the pro-Hamas terrorist sympathizers, just as these other colleges are, despite Ken Griffin and Bill Ackman making a big show of facilitating the departure of Claudine Gay, and we're not going to stand for this, and we're not going to finance this anymore. A little late. A little late in the game. I'll accept apologies, but just understand there's no thank yous that are coming at this point. The people who knew and or should have known, who dithered and dithered and dithered and did worse, actually underwrote this barbarism that you're seeing manifest on campuses. And now they want to be, oh, thank you for standing up and calling out a university president or the board of trustees or some terrorist sympathizing professor or student group. No. No. What are you going to do to make it right is the bigger question. And by the way, just holding back the next check is not enough.
Well, here's the demands from, if we want to go back to Northwestern, this is, she's one of the ladies in charge here. Oh, that's not, excuse me.
The university invests in all of these different institutions that contribute directly to the apartheid that is happening in Palestine right now. And we are fighting for divestment. And we plan to stay here until that divestment happens.
Yeah, well, that movement started about 40 years ago, so you better get comfortable. You're going to be there for a while.
Porta potties.
Over at Columbia.
Guess who's back again.
Yeah.
Who's back?
It's not Slim Shady, but it is Ilhan Omar's daughter.
Oh, yeah.
She's back
she's,
again.
Is she hungry?
And this time she returned with the big guns. Mommy. Mommy came to Columbia's campus with her baby girl to cheer on the fellow terrorist enthusiasts. As school officials reportedly, this is reported by the New York Post, school officials admitted they were no closer reaching an agreement about clearing the encampment from campus. Here's my proposal for an agreement. Either you leave the property or we give the old Richard J. Daley, shoot to maim order. How's that?
Or water cannons, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As why do they keep, at Northwestern, students who refuse to move their tents will be subject to arrest and their tents will be removed by the university.
They just issue press releases to give the appearance of doing something. These campuses are completely run by the jihadists, both in the faculty and the student body. So all of this is just PR blather from the administrative offices to give the appearance that they're in charge. They're not in charge, and it's pretty transparent to anybody paying any attention. That is the case. At USC, they've canceled graduation.
I know. The main stage commencement ceremony is gone.
So that's sad. So all those people that dummied up their resumes with crew and extracurricular activities to get into USC, they're not going to be able to graduate.
They'll be mailed their diplomas, or they can pick them up at the office. That's so sad.
Yeah, I know. All those varsity blues kids won't be able to. Yeah, it's just sad. I'm despondent.
My friend's
over
son
it.
Is supposed to graduate. He is graduating.
Oh my gosh.
Well, they're not from some sissy school or selective enrollment. Not a selective enrollment CPS school. They're from a regular CPS school. Worked hard, got into USC. Not a rich family by any means, and I think this is bull jive, and they're pissed too.
Yeah, so what? Life's rough. Get used to it. Here's the one of the parents who joined, very much like the Omar clan. Uh-huh. Dad who joined daughter in protesting genocide. USC couldn't be prouder. Oh, where are the parents? Oh, they're there. Where are the parents? The parents? They're there with the kids, saying the same things. That's where they are.
I am here to support my daughter. She's studying here, and they're protesting against the genocide. And that's why I am against the genocide. My family is against the genocide. We think that nobody, no kid deserves to be killed.
Well, why did you come down to campus?
Yeah, because my daughter started organizing too. Says, hey, we have to support Palestine. And that's why I am here. not only to support Palestine. We want the genocide to stop.
Do you know where your daughter is right now?
Right now, gotta be somewhere because the police start chasing all the students. As you see, they are threatening. If we don't leave the campus, we are gonna be arrested. But the students are so brave. Look at them. They don't want to leave the campus.
Does that concern you, though, as a father, that your daughter is somewhere?
Even though it concerns me, but my daughter did the right decision. If she rather to be arrested fighting for Palestine, I will be the happiest daddy. I will be the happiest daddy if she's doing the right thing. And I know she's doing the right thing. If the police arrest me now, I am willing to go with the students. I have no problem because what I am doing is the right thing, fighting against a genocide. I have kids, not only the teenagers, I have a 7 years old, and I imagine being a father in Palestine to see my kid be assassinated by the Israel. That's not good. We are humanity.
Oh, wow. Different parenting approach there.
Yeah. Hey, happy daddy. Anybody want to push him to comment on October 7th? Did you see what happened on October 7th? What's documented? Do you know what's happening now? As Beckett Adams over at Washington Post, Washington Examiner, excuse me, reports, Hamas is out there releasing proof-of-life videos featuring American hostages with missing limbs. And that barely merits below-the-fold coverage from the media and the Biden administration. Or these parents of all these heroic kids protesting genocide.
I mean, he's
not to mention
Chicago.
What happened. Not to mention what happened on October 7th. Let's recall the order of events, since some people are having trouble doing that. That was the precipitating event for the response, and I see the NPR Times saying that there's some anti-war encampment at Northwestern. Is that what they are? Is that what the pro-Hamas, pro-Iran, death to Israel, death to America protesters are? Are they anti-war protesters? Is that what they are, peaceniks? So what they really are is they're anti-response to terrorist attacks protesters. Is that anti-war?
Well, what somebody should do is go to Northwestern's campus and have a picture of Hirsch Goldberg, Poland. He's from Chicago. Remember, he's the one who got his hand blown off by a grenade. He was at the music concert, and everybody thought, oh, my God, I mean, he's going to bleed out. Who's going to care for him? Well, he popped up in a video 2 days ago.
Mom, Dad, Libby, and Orly, I love you so much and miss you so much, and I think of you every day that I'm here, he says.
And, I mean, I was shocked to see that he survived this long. But he's one of five American hostages that are still being held, and nobody cares about them. Biden doesn't talk about them on a daily basis or even a weekly or even a monthly. He never talks about them.
Roland in Munster, Indiana.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. It was exciting watching USC quarterback Caleb Williams walk across the stage yesterday.
Yeah.
But as a parent of a senior graduating at USC, I just find it disgusting that USC has been given into campus terrorists and not letting these kids graduate with the full pomp and circumstance that they deserve. You know, my son was a student athlete at USC, lived through the first 2 years of COVIDian, draconian shutdown, being forced to be triple vaxxed, and if he didn't get it, he couldn't compete. So right now, you know, I'm very emotional regarding, you know, everything that's happened at USC and how they've handled everything. They've been on the wrong side of history. I think about everything in the last 4 years that my son went through in California.
What sport did he play?
He was a swimmer.
Yeah. Did he really swim, or did you just pay somebody to put
swimming yet at the times. You got to touch the wall. Your name's on that data.
There you go.
We're not at Varsity Blues over here. Well, where are you going to go? Did you buy a ticket? Because my friends, they bought a ticket for graduation to go down there.
Oh, well, we're all headed in there. Now we're limited to 8 people to come in. So the whole family can't even go together to see the graduation, the little bit that's left of it.
Wait.
So
what?
We're limited to 8 tickets now. So it's a shame. As you know, my son worked really hard to get in USC, you know, academically and athletically. And watching these 4 years between the shutdowns just been miserable.
I mean, did you graduate from college, Roland?
Yes, I did.
Uh-oh. Sorry.
Why did we let him on the phone?
Did you go to your graduation?
Absolutely, I did.
I mean,
you didn't go to your graduation, Dan?
I did, but I only did it because for my parents. I mean, I didn't want to go. It was stupid.
Oh my god, I went to mine. It was a little boring.
But is your son like really geeked about going to graduation, or does he care? He's just like doing it for dad.
Well, we have a fraternity bar called the 9-0 on campus, and all the parents and kids meet there at 4:30 in the morning before graduation. It's a tradition, so it's kind of a fun last hurrah, right?
Well, why don't you just do that? Why don't you just forget the graduation? He can put his cap and gown and just go drink all day. Celebrate Caleb Williams. But Caleb Williams is buying.
Yeah, Caleb.
Yeah.
Get your nails done first, and then go.
I think I got 85,000 reasons.
I get that.
A year to spend to go to the last graduation.
Yeah, I get that. I want my money's worth. You know, I want everything I paid for. I get that.
I'd be crying if my sons were graduating, I couldn't go because they canceled the ceremony because of these domestic terrorists. I'd be pissed too.
Yeah, I got. But here's the thing, though, is you know. I mean, I don't, you know, I hate to be unfeeling about it, but I don't really have feelings, so I'm just going to be that way.
I'm with Roland on that one.
But so, you know where you're sending your kids, right? You know what's possible at these incubators of totalitarianism now, don't you? You know that at any moment, for any ridiculous reason, some grievance group can turn the campus upside down. You know this going in.
I haven't seen anything you knew it going in. Tech. I'm watching it.
And you knew it 4 years ago. Because this didn't just sneak up on anybody. Yeah, there are exceptions out there, Georgia Tech. You know, the Hillsdale's not having a real problem either. But that's not the point. You send them to state schools. You send them to these elite left schools. You got to build that into the price, don't you? I mean, if we're being honest. Yeah. Okay.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So yesterday, oral arguments in the presidential immunity case. And I thought the best exchanges were between Justice Alito, and DOJ attorney Dreeben. I love Dreeben in A Naked Gun. Oh, no, that was Frank Drebin.
Frank Drebin.
Yeah, yeah.
Michael Dreeben. And
that said,
that I knew that.
Mm-hmm. Here is some of what Trump's attorney, John Sauer, had to say in terms of trying to present the argument on behalf of Trump in some presidential context, other hypotheticals about presidents who could have been prosecuted for official acts under the theory that's being advanced by the federal government.
The implications of the court's decision here extend far beyond the facts of this case. Could President George W. Bush have been sent to prison for obstructing an official proceeding or allegedly lying to Congress to induce war in Iraq? Could President Obama be charged with murder for killing U.S. citizens abroad by drone strike? Could President Biden someday be charged with unlawfully inducing immigrants to enter the country illegally for his border policies? The answer to all these questions is no. Prosecuting the president for his official acts is an innovation with no foothold in history or tradition and incompatible with our constitutional structure.
And so there was a lot of back and forth about the distinguishing between official acts and private acts. But just on the issue of official acts, if we can forestall the discussion of where the lines are between the official and the private, the exchanges between Alito and this Department of Justice attorney, really interesting. What you're supposed to believe about the check on, presidential criminal acts, and the question that always comes up in these situations. Well, what are the checks on the checkers? Take a listen.
Just briefly review the layers of protection that you think exists, and I'm going to start with what the D.C. Circuit said. So the first layer of protection is that attorneys general and other Justice Department attorneys can be trusted to act in a professional and ethical manner, right?
Yes.
How robust is that protection? I mean, most of the vast majority of attorneys general and Justice Department of attorneys, and we both served in the Justice Department for a long time, are honorable people, and they take their professional ethical responsibilities seriously. But there have been exceptions, right, both among attorneys general and among federal prosecutors.
There have been rare exceptions, Justice Alito. But
so as for attorneys general, there have been two who were convicted of criminal offenses while in office. There were others. A. Mitchell Palmer's one that comes to mind, who is widely regarded as having abused the power of his office. Would you agree with that?
I would, but they are two officials in a long line of attorneys generals who did not, and in departments of justice that are staffed by multiple people who do adhere to their office.
So moving on to the second level of protection that the D.C. Circuit cited, federal grand juries will shield former presidents from unwarranted indictments. How much protection is that?
Well, it affords two levels of protection. One is the probable cause finding requires evidence. I think some of the fears about groundless prosecutions aren't supported by evidence, and they're not going to get out of the starting gate.
I mean, there's the old saw about indicting a ham sandwich.
Yes, but I think Justice Alito,
you had a lot of experience in the Justice Department. You come across a lot of cases where the U.S. attorney or another federal prosecutor really wanted to indict a case and the grand jury refused to do so. You had a lot of experience in the Justice Department. You come across a lot of cases where the U.S. attorney or another federal prosecutor really wanted to indict a case and the grand jury refused to do so.
There are such cases. Yes. But I think that the other
every level once in a while there's an eclipse, too.
Well, I think that's for the most reason is prosecutors have no incentive to bring a case to a grand jury and secure an indictment when they don't have evidence to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. It's self-defeating.
So here's what the federal government is arguing, if picking up on that, that the protection against opening up presence to criminal liability ostensibly for official acts, since there's no real argument about private acts. In fact, John Sauer, Trump's attorney, conceded the point that there's a difference between official and private acts, and private acts are should not be entitled to immunity, but official acts should be. Okay, so that's what we're arguing. And the protection against this being purely political, the argument that the Department of Justice lawyer makes is, one, the integrity of the Department of Justice and prosecutors, federal prosecutors. And two is the discernment of grand juries. You buy that?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36. type in DA, then a quick comment.
Because if you don't buy that, then we have a problem. We are on the cusp of establishing a precedent that Sam Alito, I think, argues persuasively, I agree with him, that is destabilizing, where every election presents the opportunity for a political vendetta to be exacted against a former president by his or her victor, right? What we're seeing now.
Let me end with just a question about what is required for the functioning of a stable democratic society, which is something that we all want. I'm sure you would agree with me that a stable democratic society requires that a candidate who loses an election, even a close one, even a hotly contested one, leave office peacefully, if that candidate is the incumbent.
Of course.
All right. Now, if an incumbent who loses a very close, hotly contested election knows that a real possibility after leaving office is not that the president is going to be able to go off into a peaceful retirement, but that the president may be criminally prosecuted by a bitter political opponent, will that not lead us into a cycle that destabilizes the functioning of our country as a democracy? And we can look around the world and find countries where we have seen this process, where the loser gets thrown in jail.
So I think it's exactly the opposite, Justice Alito. There are lawful mechanisms to contest the results in an election. And outside the record, but I think of public knowledge, petitioner and his allies filed dozens of electoral challenges. And my understanding is lost all but one that was not outcome determinative in any respect. There were judges that said in order to sustain substantial claims of fraud that would overturn an election result that's certified by a state, you need evidence, you need proof. And none of those things were manifested. So,
Trump did avail himself of the courts, very conventional way, challenging election results. He availed himself of novel legal theories about alternative elector slates to send to D.C. and have the vice president presiding over the certification decide which electors to ratify and which to not. I don't agree that that's the power that Mike Pence had in that situation under the law. But it was a legal theory. It was on the advice of competent counsel. So then what are we talking about here? The ironic thing to me is Michael Dreeben, this Department of Justice attorney, is saying, look, the kind of stuff that you're talking about, the kind of using the law to punish a political opponent after he leaves office, that's not going to happen because we have these safeguards. We have the Department of Justice. We have the grand jury system. We have ways to contest elections through the courts that candidates who lost can utilize. So Dreeben is saying what is actually happening, it can't happen. We have all these safeguards. So what you're saying, is a theoretical risk, but not a substantive one. Except this is what's happening right now, which is sort of what Roberts was getting to. And Roberts is back and forth with the Department of Justice attorney is important because I think this is where this decision is going to go. Roberts is getting to the point of this sort of the justification for the prosecution of the president is that he's being prosecuted. And the concern, the Alito concern about destabilizing our representative republic by allowing victorious candidates over incumbent presidents to use the legal system to punish them after the fact by trumping up criminal charges that relate to official acts. That's not possible, except it's happening. You follow that?
Benjamin Franklin said, as we view the prosecution of a chief exec.
Roberts and Dreeben.
A former president can be prosecuted because he's being prosecuted.
Well, I would not suggest that that's either the proper approach in this case or certainly not the government's approach. A prosecution does, of course, invoke federal criminal law. The allegations have to be presented to a grand jury, which votes upon the indictment.
Well, that's what I mean, shortly after that statement in the court, court's opinion, that's what they said. But there's no reason to worry because the prosecutor will act in good faith, and there's no reason to worry because a grand jury will have returned the indictment. Mm-hmm. Now, you know how easy it is in many cases for a prosecutor to get a grand jury to bring an indictment, and reliance on the good faith of the prosecutor may not be enough in the some cases. I'm not suggesting here. So if it's tautological, and those are the only protections that the Court of Appeals below gave, and that is no longer your position, you're not defending that position, why shouldn't we either send it back to the Court of Appeals or issue an opinion making clear that that's not the law?
Well, I am defending the Court of Appeals judgment, and I do think that there are layered safeguards that the court can take into account that will ameliorate concerns about unduly chilling presidential conduct.
Mm-hmm. Right. These safeguards you speak of, right? Because the incorruptibility, impossible to politicize prosecutors at the Department of Justice. And grand juries who, as Alito referred to, you know, once every eclipse, don't go the direction they're led by a prosecutor. Oh, and by the way, what's the conviction rate at the federal level? 95%? Oh, but no, a prosecutor is disincentivized from bringing a case that he can't prove for political reasons. Why? What's the disincentive? They've got overwhelming resources and a presumption of righteousness by that exists among a majority of the public. Right. I mean, you can say this is proved beyond a reasonable doubt and innocent until proven guilty by that standard. And what most people default to is if they've been charged, the federal government has to have a pretty good reason. I think that's becoming less and less the case as the federal government undermines its credibility, as the Department of Justice specifically has undermined its credibility. But these safeguards that the Department of Justice attorney suggests exists may exist in a textbook, but they don't exist in America anymore. And it's prosecutors like Jack Smith that are the reason they don't. It's attorneys general like Merrick Garland that are the reason they don't. And I think what you heard there from Roberts, who I suspect will write the majority opinion in this case, you got a little bit of a tell. Send it back to the D.C. Court of Appeals and have them weigh in on what they believe the law says. It's a legitimate prosecution because he's being prosecuted. That's not a legal argument. It's not even a logical argument. It's just a tautological one, as they both agreed. And if that happens, well, then that takes this case. Well, I mean, which is probably going to happen anyway, but it definitely takes this case past November. And it should, because this is a momentous case. The precedent that the Supreme Court sets here will be impactful on future presidents and, by extension, the larger operation of our Republican form of government. Unless you think that presidents using the justice system to exact political vendettas through the criminal courts on past presidents is something that will not negatively impact our politics or polity or the operation of our government. I don't think anybody believes that. Look at what's happening now. So the Supreme Court is rightly reticent, at least most of the justices, to codify what's happening now, regardless of their view on Trump or Biden. They're at least looking at the impact through the ages, not just through the 2024 election. Tom in Schererville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan, grand juries can indict a ham sandwich, so it doesn't mean anything. And a lot of these people that sit on juries, grand juries, or any other kind of jury, it seems to me in the last 10 years, they're all Democrats. Do Republicans ever get picked to be on a jury? I mean, I'm a registered Republican. I never get picked. I never get summoned for jury service.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Joe in Naperville.
Yeah, you know, I had a laugh when I actually listened to the entire hearing at the Supreme Court. And my takeaway was those who think you can trust the government, if that was the Joe Biden's Department of Justice position, look what Colorado tried to do to Trump, take him off a ballot. Boy, I really want to trust these guys. They just because they're in power, they know exactly what's right and what they could do.
Well, that's at the state level, you know, That's not the high standards of ethical conduct that federal prosecutors hold themselves to. I'm joking because it's the same problem. I mean, we talked about this case yesterday, the indictments that were handed down in Arizona at the state level against Trump associates over this alternate elector slate.
Fake electors.
So this Chris Mays, the attorney general, state of Arizona. Democrat, of course. Here's her on March 30th on MSNBC.
Well, you know, as my colleague from Massachusetts just mentioned, we absolutely have to get President Biden reelected because one of my fears is, despite the fact that, you know, Republicans said they wanted to send this back to states for states to decide, I think there's a real movement in the sort of extreme elements.
So that was 4 weeks ago, 4 weeks before Chris Mays came forward with indictments against those Trump associates. Because she's worried about, I mean, not, but I shouldn't say because, but. She, 4 weeks earlier, she's arguing we have to get Biden reelected because even though Trump said abortion should be left to the states, I don't believe him. And so we need to derail him. And 4 weeks later, she's issuing indictments against his associates. But no, that's, you know, again, integrity, attorneys general. We have attorney general as the backstop. We have federal prosecutors as the backstop. We have grand juries as the backstop. We're all watching what attorneys generals and state and federal prosecutors are doing. And a whole hell of a lot of us are coming to the conclusion that they don't serve as much of a backstop. And that's what some of the justices, at least Alito and others, were getting at. Greg in Schaumburg.
Dan and Amy, thanks. Real quick. First of all, whatever the Supreme Court comes up with on this, it's hard to teach people to be ethical, and the Democrats are going to cheat, steal, and lie and do anything around whatever the Supreme Court states. And then the second thing is, as evidence of this, of the problem, in the Bragg case, everybody in this country should be outraged because the way they're setting this up is the crime that's financial, the financial entries, is the predicate for the crime. The next crime, and the next crime wasn't fully really defined even yet, but after the trial started. That is not fair.
It's not defined at all. The cover up of what crime, we still don't know what crime.
Exactly.
Thanks for the call, Greg. No, but because you have ciphers like Mitt Romney makes, you know, snide comments about you don't pay a stripper $130,000 or a porn star $130,000 to not have sex. Whatever. You want to pass judgment on Trump's moral character? That's fine. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the rule of law. Right. We're talking about what the law says, Senator Romney.
And she could have been extorting him because she went to the National Enquirer first.
Whatever. Whatever she was doing is irrelevant to the law. This business records case, they have nothing. They don't even have a charge. But Mitt Romney is really helping by being flip about this. If you want to take a shot at Trump, then provide the same line of distinction I'm providing. There is the moral issue of whatever his relationship was or wasn't with Stormy Daniels, and we can talk about that. But first, we're going to talk about the law and what criminal courts are and are not for. And you want me to judge a federal prosecutor? Oh, federal Alvin Bragg. By the way, Alvin Bragg, interestingly, in the news yesterday again, when the rape conviction for Harvey Weinstein was overturned. That's his case. Mm-hmm. And the rape conviction for Harvey Weinstein should have been overturned.
Right.
Because he bungled that case, too, by bringing in, and so did the judge, by allowing witnesses to testify who were not part of the underlying charges against Weinstein. That was prejudicial. That's basic. Mr. Harvard-trained local prosecutor in Manhattan, big shot.
Well, one of the Spice Girls went on MSNBC, and basically, I mean, she might have slipped, but she explained why they're having this trial in New York.
And, you know, I go back to the responsibility of Congress here, mm-hmm. Because had the Senate actually gone through with the impeachment of Donald Trump,
hello,
we would not be in this situation.
Oh, okay.
So Bragg, I mean, it's, you know, what, is he incompetent? Is he just lawless? Is it some combination of the two? I don't know. But all of this high-minded talk, these prosecutors that have, they're so full of themselves, the cannons, and, well, we're watching. What you say versus what we see so many of your brethren do in this moment, and so many of you sit idly by while they do it. Sorry. No sale.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
And, you know, I go back to the responsibility of Congress here, mm-hmm. Because had...
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We were talking about the arguments before the high court yesterday between... And the issue of presidential immunity, with justices questioning both John Sauer, Trump's attorney, as well as attorneys for the Department of Justice. And essentially, the argument that was advanced in the face of skepticism from justices about criminalizing official acts of the president is you can trust the attorney generals. You can trust attorneys general, you know, prospectively. You can trust the DOJ prosecutors, and you can trust grand juries. And that's all you need to know. Somebody pointed out a text from 847. Right. So we can trust the good character and ethical standards of prosecutors, but not presidents, of attorneys general, but not presidents. Oh, that's fine. So we've got a DOJ check on the president. Let's just play this argument out. And who's the check on the DOJ?
And who trusts the DOJ now anyway?
Who's the check on them?
I don't know. Nobody.
What I'm sure that DOJ attorney Dreeben would tell me is, oh, it's there's congressional oversight. Oh, really? And that congressional oversight has been able to, over the last, say, several years, hold bad actors, or at least people in positions of authority who have, at minimum, committed ethical breaches. That's not me saying it. That's like the DOJ Inspector General saying that about Jim Comey and Andy McCabe. And I'm told there's congressional oversight, and this is who holds the prosecutors and their law and their investigative arm, the FBI, accountable, really. And I'm still waiting for Christopher Wray to tell me whether there were or were not FBI assets on the ground on January 6th, for example. The same FBI that abused FISA, the same FBI, in terms of spying on Americans, and in addition to in terms of spying on the Trump campaign. All of the ethical breaches over the last 8 years. The FBI agent who forged a email, Kevin Kleinsmith, one of the few actually prosecuted modestly at that. But again, oh, sure, there's some exceptions, but generally speaking, no. maybe once upon a time, generally speaking, you could give the benefit of the doubt. What we see now, you have to be out of your mind if you think that the people who've behaved the way that they have behaved in positions of substantial power are to be given the benefit of the doubt. You have to be out of your mind. Willful blindness doesn't cover it. The performance of the last couple of FBI directors, the performance of this attorney general, the performance of federal prosecutors and special counsels. We're not even to the state prosecutors and state attorneys general, like we just talked about in Arizona with Chris Mays, or in Michigan with Dana Nussel. Out of your mind. You think that is what it protects the republic, those institutions, as manifestly, spectacularly, publicly corrupt as they've demonstrated themselves to be? I mean, I know that the Supreme Court is not the place for such rhetorical flourishes, and I know you're not going to get such rhetorical flourishes from an Alito or a Thomas, but it had to be crossing their minds yesterday during oral arguments. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Mark Pulliam. Mark is an attorney himself. Thus, we can ensure that he holds himself to the highest ethical standards, just like all those prosecutors at DOJ. He's a lawyer and writer living in East Tennessee. He blogs at misruleoflaw.com. Mark, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Pleased to be here.
I mean, you know, we can start with the Arizona indictment, since that probably more closely approximates the recent piece you wrote on John Eastman in terms of relevance. And there are more yet to come, potentially, as I just alluded to, with the Michigan investigation by the attorney general there into the alternate elector slate there. Why is what's happening, whether it's in Fulton County or Arizona or Michigan, to John Eastman, but not limited to John Eastman, why is this important?
Well, as you pointed out in your opening comments, the legal system in America has historically been viewed as the mechanism for protecting and defending individual rights, for preserving our liberty. But in the hands of the left in recent years, it has been weaponized as now a tool of oppression. And what is happening to John Eastman and other attorneys representing Republican elected officials, in particular President Trump, is that they've turned the tables and are now demonizing these lawyers and seeking to ruin them through lawfare, which is using legal and criminal proceedings to destroy your political opponents. But in the case of John Eastman and these other attorneys, Jeff Clark is one, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, they're going after also, is they're trying to really revolutionize the role of lawyers who have, by zealously representing unpopular clients throughout American history, starting with John Adams representing the British soldiers accused of murdering civilians in the so-called Boston Massacre in 1770, but going on through the Civil Rights Movement, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her litigation on behalf of women's rights, the ACLU, et cetera, we've celebrated these people because they've pushed the limits of the law to achieve social change. The difference is that social change was considered legally or desirable from a policy standpoint from the left. Now that you have Republican or conservative lawyers pushing the limits, zealously representing their clients in legal proceedings, that the left hates that and is seeking to destroy these people and are succeeding. That, you know, Donald Trump is the subject of a lot of this lawfare, but he's a billionaire. He has a public pulpit. But these individual attorneys, like John Eastman, you know, he's not a rich man. And so when he's hauled before a congressional committee, he faces disbarment proceedings in in California that go on for an unprecedented 35 days and so forth, he's becoming financially ruined. He's had to spend $1.5 million so far, and the Georgia proceedings haven't even really warmed up. Mm-hmm. And on Wednesday of this week, as you mentioned, Arizona has now indicted him and others. It is a calculated campaign to not just ruin John Eastman and these other individual lawyers, but to send an unmistakable message to other lawyers in private practice that if you ever think about intervening in an election to try to challenge an election that is won by a Democrat, we will ruin you, we will destroy your career, we will try to deprive you of your livelihood. And this is a very scary thing happening in America.
Well, how is it a crime, though, to provide legal advice? I mean, that's what's the crime?
Well, this is, it's like being in Alice in Wonderland. They've decided that any challenge to an election is equivalent to insurrection, even though Democrats have challenged elections and are celebrated for doing so. Hillary Clinton is still challenging the results of the 2016 election. And they say that, you know, particular legal advice was fraudulent, it was dishonest, it was a conspiracy. It's flimsy, but, and he will, I think, eventually, if he can muster the resources to defend himself, he will prevail in all of these myriad forums. But this is the real evil of lawfare, is that the process is the punishment.
You know, I'll tell you, I just want to zero in on something you just said about Eastman, because it's just, it's we see a pattern. So there are no victims in the civil trial about the Trump related to the Trump organization. You know, all the banks are fine. Nobody cried foul, but the attorney general steps in. There is no victim in the quote-unquote business records case, which, as I was just reminded, isn't even a business records case because the checks came out of his personal account.
Right.
there's no victim there. And with respect to John Eastman, you know, the fraudulent legal advice, quote-unquote, there's also no victim because his client isn't crying foul. So, I mean, it's...
And all of the electoral votes were counted on January 6th.
Correct.
Exactly on schedule. So
there's nothing to remedy. Yes.
Yes.
Right. I mean, it's just and the other thing I want to emphasize, too, because you're right about the message this sends and that Republicans are on notice. Republican lawyers, anybody in the Federal Society, anybody Leonard Leo's ever had lunch with, you're on notice that we're going to try to get you disbarred and imprisoned if you get if you dip your toe into politics. The other message it sends to their side's attorneys is do everything you can. Everywhere, anywhere and everywhere you are, to put your political opponents in this box that Trump is in. Get them off the campaign trail, you know, bankrupt them or have them expend resources, personal and political. This is you know, lawfare. It's politics by other means. This is just aggressive campaigning. Put them in the criminal defendant's chair and let them expend their time and resources while you're out campaigning. And if you could do it at the presidential level, then why not do it in governor's races or Senate races or congressional races?
And that's their goal. So we have a complete lack of symmetry on this. So Mark Elias and his fellow Democrat lawyers can sue all these different states in 2020 to challenge existing election laws to permit wide open mail ballots and ballot harvesting and make changes that were not approved by the state legislatures. And that's considered okay. That's celebrated. But if any Republican lawyer pushes back or tries to resist that, they become the subject. And this is an organized campaign. It's not just organic, accidental. David Brock and his 65 Project, which is a dark money,
right,
left-wing organization, they have targeted specific lawyers. And they even say, and if they are modest means, it makes it a more vulnerable target. And that's why we're going after the little guys, because if you can destroy the little guys, then you're really sending a strong message. It's pernicious, and your listeners should realize if they can get away with this with John Eastman, a former Supreme Court clerk, graduate of the University of Chicago Law School, practiced law at Kirkland & Ellis. He is a stellar legal talent. But if they can destroy him, they could go after any one of your listeners. They've deplatformed him from his banking relationships. They picket his house. They put nail strips across his driveway to flatten his tires. He is being persecuted. For what reason? Because he defended President Donald Trump in the 2020 election. This should shock your listeners, and this should not be happening in America, and we can't let them succeed.
Mark Pulliam is a lawyer and writer living in East Tennessee. He blogs at misruleoflaw.com. Mark, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So those construction workers that Trump met before he had to get into court yesterday and appear before Judge Juan Torquemada, they had something to say to those who queried them about their support for Trump. This gentleman, he's got a message for Biden.
What's it like seeing so many Republicans in Manhattan, so many Trump supporters in Manhattan? Does that surprise you?
No, not at all. It's turning now. Trump's turn again.
What's your message to Joe Biden?
F*** you.
I love that guy. Yeah. I must have listened to that 20 times yesterday. It was just so invigorating.
It's elegant in its simplicity. Bob Bartels is the business manager for the Steamfitters Local 638. He was on with Brian Kilmeade on Fox and Friends explaining what you see with the position of the national building trades honchos and them hosting Joe Biden to chant four more years pause with is very different than what's happening at the local level with the rank and file, like his membership, in terms of where support is going. This isn't surprising, but it is indicative that there's, I think, more than 50-50 chance that we're going to see a repeat of 2016 along the same fault lines.
Great to see the president come and engaging with the blue-collar worker of New York City. We basically built New York. The union movement has made the middle class. And we are very patriotic union, and we are pro-America. So my members right now, I put out a poll in my union. President Trump is leading Joe Biden 3-1 on my presidential poll out of my 9,000 members right now. We are very tired of the situation with groceries, inflation, gas prices, illegal immigration, crime. We are living it every day in New York City.
So spot on. I mean, I keep thinking if Biden's elected, that the border's it's going to remain open. Taxes are going to go up. Women's sports are going to end. Mortgage rates will remain high, if not go up. Inflation's going to continue, and crime's going to continue.
Well, on the matter of the migrants, yeah. It's interesting what's happening at some of our Western friends, similarly disposed to the left socialist fantasies here, like open borders. This is none other than the Amazon Post reporting, by the way. Amid a housing affordability crisis and a strain on social services, Justin Trudeau's government is rolling up the welcome mat for some immigrants. To cap the number of permanent residents it will welcome, announced a temporary limit on international student visas, and pledged to shrink the population or the proportion of the population made up of temporary immigrants, such as foreign workers.
Well, that's not very welcoming, Dan.
No, it isn't. That's not what I expect from a former grade school drama teacher. I expect more compassion. What is this business? It's almost like he's saying that some people can be illegal, and we know that no one can be illegal. Rishi Sunak, he would fit right in with the surrender, some surrender Republicans in like the Senate Republican caucus. He and I think Mitt Romney would be fast friends. So this is not somebody who's particularly strident or philosophically consistent or conservative. And yet here was his big announcement this week. Deportation flights, they're going to happen.
No ifs, no buts. These flights are going to Rwanda. And most importantly, once the processing is complete, we will physically remove people. And to do that, I can confirm that we've put an airfield on standby, booked commercial charter planes for specific slots, and we have 500 highly trained individuals ready to escort illegal migrants all the way to Rwanda, with 300 more trained in the coming weeks. This is one of the most complex operational endeavours the Home Office has carried out. But we are ready. Plans are in place. And these flights will go come what may. No foreign court will stop us from getting flights off. Rwanda is ready too. And I'd like to thank the government of Rwanda for their work in strengthening their asylum system, passing legislation, and setting up a new appeals tribunal.
Now that's real leadership. And if we should do something here, then where would we send them? What country would we send them to?
What do you mean? You send them back to the countries from whence they came. I mean, pretty straightforward. And on the topic of what Trump has been talking about, which is a promise of mass deportations, it's interesting. That was the sort of rhetoric that would get people decrying him as a xenophobe and so on and so forth a few years ago. Now it's a position supported by 51% of the general public, according to an Axios-Harris poll that's out. 30% of Democrats and 46% of Republicans now say they'd end birthright citizenship, which is constitutionally guaranteed at present. Remarkable turn of affairs. And it's so much so that a handful of Democrats are calling on Biden to reinstate Biden. Oh, so he can do something. Biden to reinstate Title 42 and remain in Mexico immigration policies. Democrat Marie Perez, Washington State, Jared Golden, Maine, Mary Peltola, Alaska, Vicente Gonzalez, Texas, Don Davis, North Carolina. Huh. So this is why I say there are some wild cards. There are some variables that are different than 2016, but it seems eerily reminiscent along many metrics. For more on the topic and perhaps a couple of others, we're pleased to be joined by Noah Rothman. He's senior writer at National Review. He's also the author of The Rise of the New Puritans, Fighting Back Against Progressives' War on Fun. Noah, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I saw I read the piece that you wrote about sort of the potential voter problems that both Biden and Trump have. You know, if Biden loses, it'll be this reason. If Trump loses, it'll be for that reason. So I'll let you distill that. But I mean, the working class, the blue collar union types that maybe don't show up in midterm elections, but do show up for Trump. It seems like that enthusiasm is still present, particularly since he's performing better in swing states now than almost he ever has. And this open borders issue is something that even some Democrats are recognizing as a millstone.
Yes, that clip that you played of the very stereotypical, you know, blue-collar New Yorker who I grew up with, I know that guy. And that guy is a very familiar guy. He's a dying breed in New York City, but he's the kind of person I grew up with in the 80s, 90s. And his comments strike me as sort of the election, the theory of the election from both parties in microcosm, you know, just really zooming out over the last couple of decades. The coalitions have been changing. The last vestiges of the Democratic New Deal coalition are kind of falling away. And that was this really broad coalition of voters that in FDR's time included, you know, African Americans in the South and actual racists in the South and workers in the North and professionals with degrees. It was a much broader coalition. But as the Democratic Party has begun to rely more and more on degree holders, it has gotten smaller. There's just not enough of them. And one of the things that I've written about is if Joe Biden loses, you can see why he loses now because they've relied on this coalition of voters. That is just not a big coalition of voters. There aren't a lot of people in this country that have four-year degrees, like 30% of the country, self-reported, which means it's probably less. And those people, you know, they respond to different incentives than the vast majority of voters. All of the Democratic Party's problems are downstream from that. The issues that they focus on, which are so niche and boutique, like climate change and structural racism and what have you. But the thing about that coalition that's valuable is they turn out to vote in every election, off years, specials, midterms, generals. They're there because they're hyper-educated, they're hyper-aware, and they're always informed on politics, and they like voting, something they do as a hobby. The Republican Party, by contrast, has begun to attract less educated voters, fewer people who have those four-year degrees. Now, the thing about that that's advantageous is there's a lot more of them. So in a high engagement election, like a presidential election, it's a real risk to have a coalition that's small because you expect a big turnout. The only problem with that coalition is it's not a reliable voting block. They don't always turn out at the polls. Maybe it'll turn out in a presidential year. In fact, that's the theory that Republicans are working on. But as we've learned over the last couple of cycles, midterms, specials, off years, that Democrats have been winning unexpectedly, they're not reliable voters in those elections, which is a bad trade-off. So now the theory gets tested here in 2024. Does this enthusiasm among this broad universe of low-propensity voters sweep out a very high-propensity but smaller coalition of voters that's loyal to the Democratic Party? Big question mark, and that's basically the whole theory of the race at this point.
Yeah, the other piece of this too. I mean, even going assuming that you get the turnout plus from that coalition that Trump got in, really in 2016 and 2020, seems poised to get again. But in terms of sustaining it, you know, just sort of antagonism. You know, you talk about the degreed class that provides the base of the Democrat Party as in niche issues. So, but it's not just that they're niche issues, that they're sort of not front and center for more blue collar voters. It's also that they're openly hostile and antagonistic, and it's generating that FU response you heard from the construction workers. It's not just like you're not paying attention to me. It's also like, you know, could you just stop with open borders and forcing my kid at this grade school to listen to a drag queen read him stories and all the other business and you know, yeah. these animals I'm watching at Columbia University, and this is after Black Lives Matter destroyed the downtown of the city I live in or live around, and you know, it's on and on and on, the open hostility.
That's exactly right. They don't share the same sensibilities as probably most of the country. So Rishi Sunak, that clip that you played of him announcing these deportation flights, would be a great thing for Joe Biden to have done when he restarted, inexplicably after having stopped it for literally no reason, deportation flights to Venezuela. Restarted that, I think, late last year. But Joe Biden can't give that speech. In fact, Joe Biden can't give a speech about the big legislative victory he just won. He just got the Congress to pass a big package of foreign aid for embattled allies abroad that he's been seeking forever. Have you heard him talk about it?
Right.
No. He can't celebrate it. Because he would have to say, well, we're supporting our ally Israel in its defensive war against Gaza. And he's afraid to say that, even though that's his policy. That's what he wants to do. It's what he's been advocating. And he can't go out and tout his own successes for fear of antagonizing this very small rump of extremely agitated, very loud, very telegenic in the worst possible sense, coalition of voters that is, you know, one of the most front and center representatives of this highly educated, upwardly mobile, affluent, and utterly unrepresentative coalition that the Democratic Party has courted.
So, Noah Rothman, President Trump is stuck in a courtroom, can't campaign 5 days out of the week. What do you make of President Biden out there on the campaign trail so far?
Well, I haven't seen much of him. In fact, that's one of the frustrations. I heard Andrea Mitchell complain about this, saying that the trials were actually giving Donald Trump too much airtime, which is kind of contrary to the theory that was retailed ahead of his trials, that the fact that he's getting too much airtime and Joe Biden's not getting enough was a source of concern for partisans in the press who are obviously Democratic-leaning. I don't know if that's necessarily true. I haven't been borne out in polling. We don't see any evidence that the trials are actually helping Donald Trump with the general electorate. They help him with Republicans, but you need more than Republicans. Nevertheless, the assumption here that Joe Biden needs more camera time and can somehow capture it, can somehow capture the nation's attention, I don't see any evidence of it. I don't know how he does it. What is he going to do to reshape the narrative if he can't even articulate, as we were just talking about, articulate the case for his own presidency, because he's afraid if he were to articulate the case for himself in a general election, it would alienate his core voters. He's in a bit of a pickle in that sense.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, the whole he's getting too much airtime. Well, you may not want to try to former president of the United States in Manhattan. There's a lot of media there. I don't know if you know, not to mention just media that's attended to everything that Trump does and says for a variety of reasons. So the idea that he won't be able to campaign because you got him boxed in that courtroom. Well, he goes out and stands with construction workers. He goes out to the bodegas and stands with Jose Alba and talks to them. He's bringing in a former PM of Japan and having a little tete-a-tete there before he has to go to court. I mean, that's plenty on a 24-hour basis for the news cycle.
So it's pretty clever because Donald Trump has to, by order of Judge Merchant, he has to be in the courtroom every day that there is a trial. And that's hindering his campaign appearances. So they've done something creative where they're like going to bodegas and having interactions with voters in the street and trying to make events out of that. And it's an interesting small bore style that's also very humanizing in a way that is advantageous to Donald Trump. And it's reflective, and there's some people who are saying, well, that's not the people who are turning out, they're not representative of Harlem voters, really, right? I mean, Donald Trump is going to lose Harlem and New York City and Manhattan broadly by like 20 points in November, and that's true. But if the theory of the race is, as we've been talking about, more non-degree-holding voters leaning Republican, you would expect to see that. You would expect to see the margins tighten significantly in dark blue areas. And the same could be said for the suburbs, for example, which were used to be a Republican bastion stronghold, and now are in play or leaning Democratic because degree holders, affluent, upwardly mobile degree holders, are gravitating more towards the Democratic coalition. So you would expect to see those margins tighten across the country. The big question mark for everybody is how much will they tighten? Donald Trump's not going to win New York, so it doesn't really help him very much. But
no,
it certainly helps Republicans down ballot. It certainly helps Republicans on the margins in congressional seats and in local and municipal races.
Well, right, but they're also but that interaction with those steam fitters and other construction workers is that's a proxy. I mean, that's a microcosm, and so you know other similarly situated folks like those guys around the country see that too. So same thing with the small shop owners; they see that too, and so it's an appeal through them to others similarly situated.
But this is the Democratic Party's problem that the Republican Party has now inherited. The distribution, the geographic distribution of these voters is not advantageous. They are cultivated. They are amassed in small geographic areas that are prohibitively Democratic. You could win 20% more working class voters than you did last cycle in New York City, but it's not going to win you New York City. This is always the Democratic Party's problem, is they have more voters. That's why they always won the popular vote. But they were geographically distributed in ways that didn't advantage them in the Electoral College. And this is the problem that Republicans will now court if they want to assume the New Deal coalition, the remnants of it, from the Democratic Party. They need a broader base. You need a broad base geographically, not just demographically. And that's why the suburb should be the battleground that we're talking about here. Working class voters aren't, you know, necessarily the lunch pail type. You know, I'm in a working class neighborhood, but all of my neighbors make six figures. They work with their hands, but they make a ton of money.
Yeah,
doing
right.
These vocational
sure.
activities. So we're not
right.
talking about, you know, this stereotype that I think Democrats actually believe about what, you know, what the working class person actually is. These are upwardly mobile people, too.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, many of them have degrees under their belt, too. But they have a different sensibility, and the cultural sensibility is what we're talking about here, more than demography, more than what you're making a year.
Noel Rothman, senior writer, National Review, author of The Rise of the New Puritans, Fighting Back Against Progressives' War on Fun. Noah, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, a principal in Pikesville, Maryland, named Eric Eiswart, is in trouble for a racist rant, allegedly racist rant he went on with respect to some of his colleagues at the school.
You know, I seriously don't understand why I have to constantly put up with these dumbasses here every day. Between these ungrateful black kids who can't test their way out of a paper bag, or these teachers who don't get it, how hard is it to get these students to meet their grade level expectations? Lawrence and Ravenel should have never been hired. And don't let me get started on DJ. I'm going to drag his black ass out of here one way or another. I'm going to get something to stick. I'm just so sick of the inadequacies of these people. And if I have to get one more complaint from one more Jew in this community, I'm going to join the other side.
Yeah, I watched that online, and I was shocked at what happened.
DJ, as DJ Darian, he's a former athletic director, and he was arrested because that recording that was ostensibly the principal at Pikesville High School was not the principal at Pikesville High School. It was an AI fake that DJ Darian made up to try and take out the principal.
I mean, can you make, because people are saying he doesn't talk like that. He's not racist. He would never say that in a million years. And that is scary, because if it happens to him, it can happen to anybody in this country.
The former athletic director made the recording, reportedly in retaliation for the principal initiating an investigation into improper payments he made to a school athletics coach who was also his roommate.
Oh, yeah.
And now the former athletic director is charged with theft as well as retaliating against a witness. But, of course, once this recording surfaced, boom, right? He had to prove his innocence. He was not given the benefit of the doubt because, well, because he's a honky. And so in our systemically racist society where all honkies are indelibly racist, can't shake it, it's in our DNA, of course you're going to give the benefit of the doubt to the former athletic director who's a black man and not the honky principal who's whose very voice you hear there saying those intemperate things. Brave new world coming. Are we ready for? Are we adult enough for the era of AI? Oh, by the way, in case you don't know what that, Kamala Harris can explain it to you. It stands for artificial intelligence. Oh, and you can check with the vice president. She can run you through the traps on it. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Something else with AI, you know, the AI being used to these nefarious ends. As racism lessens, what have we seen? As actual incidents of racism lessen, the demand increases. It's reported more often. There's a frequency graph circulating online. The term frequency in popular U.S. newspapers from 1970 to the early 2020s. Term frequency, popular newspapers, New York Times, L.A. Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. The term racist, racists, or racism. Okay. Between 2010 and 2020, the use of one of those three words in the New York Times increased by 712%. The LA Times, it increased by 756%. The Washington Post, it increased by 361%. The Wall Street Journal, it increased by 468%. In that decade between 2020 and between 2010 and 2020, as I think you would argue against the backdrop of the first black president elected in 2008, we were getting less racist, although the race hustlers were doing a good job of polarizing us, and this is what that decade of 2010 to 2020 really represented. As the evidence of racism declined, the accusations increased. Now you've got a technological innovation that allows them to increase geometrically in a more convincing fashion. You could just take somebody that you don't like and create this, you know, AI iteration of them saying intemperate things. And by the time the mob gets wind of whatever the truth is, well, the damage will have long been since done.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also text us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
There's a tweeter or an Xer named whose handle is Coddled Affluent Professional.
Okay.
And he did our culture a solid. He compiled, I should say, all the stories about foods being racist.
Oh, really?
So think about the increased incidence of using the term racist, racism, appearing in these newspapers of record over the 2010 to 2020 decade, the technological overlay of AI now, and what the D.C. press corps is oriented to report. It's not stopping. These are all, I mean, just to give you some examples. This is just a great list. And it's like, here's NPR. Tainted treats, racism, and the rise of big candy. The Sacramento Bee. Why some fish are junk, others are protected. California study points to past racism. Candy's racist, junk, fish racist. Uh-huh. The difference between yams and sweet potatoes is structural racism. The confusion goes all the way back to the transatlantic slave trade. I've always loved fried chicken, but the racism surrounding it shame me. It should be a source of pride for black people. It's complicated, though. These are news stories. I'm just reading you the headlines.
Oh, okay.
You can discern where this goes or not, but I don't care where it goes. From PETA, are meat eaters more likely to be racists? The media has erased the long history of black barbecue, skewing our understanding. From The Atlantic, a brief history of racist soft drinks. I'm checking most of it. Soft drinks, candy, chicken, fish. Checking most of the boxes. Your fancy new brunch place is probably colonialist, and you're a colonizer. Another headline, cheese is racist storm as hundreds back ban on dairy foods in school. We brought you this one. I remember this one. The unbearable whiteness of coffee. From The Guardian, is having to pay for tomato ketchup racist? ProPublica, the racism and resilience behind today's salmon crisis. Did you know there was one? Smithsonian Magazine, the fuzzy history of the Georgia peach. From the New York Times, why white supremacists are chugging milk and why geneticists are alarmed.
That's from The Onion, right?
It's from the New York Times, which is a sister publication. Food manufacturing. Oregon bakery accused of racism for Oreo cupcake.
Oh my God.
Back to the New York Times / Onion. Why is Asian salad still on the menu? I'm not done. Have I missed anything? Why we don't trust white people's potato salad explained.
Oh boy.
White people's eating habits produce most greenhouse gases, study finds. The racist history of government cheese. The women bringing BIPOC representation to the cheese industry. Boy, a lot of racism in cheese. Does the wine industry have a racism problem? Black people were denied vanilla ice cream in the Jim Crow South except on Independence Day. Eddie Huang, this is NBC News, on racial insensitivities behind MSG and Chinese food criticisms. MSG has gotten a bad rap because of racism. Racism made us believe MSG was dangerous. Now that's coming back. Racism doesn't taste very good, and other reactions to Lay's new international potato chip flavors. French food is an expression of white privilege. The socialist roots of the bagel.
Don't touch my bagel.
No, you can't touch my bagel.
Excuse me.
Because the bagel goes from those who have bagels to those who need bagels. It's socialist. And you think AI is going to help or populate this nonsense? Frank, Board of Trade, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
When you live in the land of the pygmies, you must learn how to stoop.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Frank. You want to hear a fun one? Just another like AI thing.
Please.
Even though this guy's a huge, insufferable lib, and I mean huge in multiple ways because he's also a pig. Reid Hoffman, founder of LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. It's kind of fun what he did, though. I mean, he's a smart guy in the tech space, even though he's obnoxious and ignorant in the political and policy space. But now, when it comes to AI. This is really cool what you did, and it's also you like want to see it because Reid Hoffman AI and Reid Hoffman the real guy are indistinguishable. So he sets up an interview where Reid Hoffman AI is interviewing Reid Hoffman real person.
Okay. Why would I want to be interviewed by a digital version of myself? Well, great question. Reid AI, introduce yourself to everyone.
Hello, everyone. I'm thrilled to be here today. I'm an AI-generated version of Reid Hoffman, his digital twin. My thinking and everything I am saying comes from a custom GPT that is based on 20 years of Reid talking and making content. So I've read all his books, watched his speeches, and listened to his podcasts. I think it gives me a pretty good sense of how you approach the world, Reid.
So first, I'm going to challenge Reid AI with some questions to see what it can do and how good its content is in mirroring what I might say.
Then the tables will turn and I will challenge you with some questions about AI and tech.
Of course, there's a second question, whether or not I'll answer.
Well, okay. Challenge accepted.
Let's get started. Let's take a real piece of work from me, blitzscaling. I wrote a 336-page book, and how do you explain it in one sentence? To a smart person, to a five-year-old, well, for the Star Trek fans, in Klingon, and as Jerry would explain it in Seinfeld.
Okay, condensing your entire strategy from a 336-page book into one sentence, and starting with the explanation for the smartest person in the world. Blitzscaling is a strategic acceleration of organizational growth to seize market dominance by prioritizing rapid expansion over efficiency, leveraging capital and network effects to outpace competitors in winner-takes-all markets, despite the attendant risks to scalability and operational stability. Now, for a five-year-old, blitzscaling is like building the biggest tower super fast before anyone else, even if it gets a bit messy, so you can be the leader of the tower game. And now for a Klingon, blitzscaling OH Pus Vittelheg Duj Luchar Glutavis Tilhab A Dochvam Viol, Hawk Competition Vipo Q A Market Dahara. And finally, like Jerry in a Seinfeld episode, blitzscaling, you know, it's when a company decides to floor it on the highway of business, ignoring the speed limit, racing to be the first to that big golden market share in the sky, all while hoping they don't run out of gas or, you know, hit a tree. It's like, who cares if we're burning cash like it's a bonfire? We're getting to the front of the line, baby. Efficiency? Please. That's for those in the slow lane watching us fly by.
Which explanation most appeal to you, Amy?
I like the Klingon.
Yeah, the Klingon, sure. You speak Klingon? I had no idea. Yeah, I didn't know you were a polyglot. If this goes on for, you know, another 11 minutes and then if, you know, the AI flips the script, it really is interesting. I mean, if you haven't delved into AI at all, just in terms of understanding the power of it and, you know, the potential applications. And maybe, Amy, you're talking to AI Dan right now and not the real Dan. How do you know?
Why you've been nice to me the past 2 weeks because you're the
you don't
AI
know.
Version.
You don't know.
This is all Sven.
Uh-huh.
No, I'm telling you.
Ask me to say something in Klingon.
Okay,
maybe
say something in Klingon.
No.
Say, why don't I follow Amy on Twitter in Klingon?
Greg in LaGrange on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Inside joke.
Or maybe this is AI Greg.
It might be AI Greg. The thing that scares me the most is how easily we're distracted about the most mundane and most impertinent things in society, like AI. But what it is very illustrative of our political adversaries using any tool, any weapon that they could use against our side and use it to bring us to our knees. And how is that possible? It's only through our cowardice and our willingness to stand down in the face of this evil. And it happens all the time. It's one of the signature points of the established Republican Party. They never confront what they need to confront. What scares me the most is what's going on behind the actions, which central digital-based currencies, Title IX, all that kind of stuff. As long as our adversaries have us focusing on the shiny objects, keeping our minds off the real problems, we are in big trouble. We need leaders to step up and recognize what's important and what's not. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Greg. Nick in Kenosha.
Yeah, sorry, back to the food is racist.
Yeah.
We were supposed to go to a Mother's Day a few years ago, and there's a place in Iguanago called the Cotton Exchange. Sister-in-law, who is black, she has since written off my family because she believes that we're all racist now. How dare we? Suggest we go to somewhere like that. So,
you know, Nick, I've got an idea for you. Maybe as a peace offering,
what?
Bring over some of those socialist bagels.
Yeah, I think I will. Thanks.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for the call, Nick. James in Westmont.
Yeah, the jury's still out about my intelligence, so this is definitely not AI, James. But I will say, I'm still confused about Taco Bell. It was a Mexican chain started by a honky. Is this racist in its own right?
I think it crossed over into being hopelessly racist with those little yapping dogs, the Chihuahuas in the commercials, right? The Chihuahuas with the Mexican accent, right?
Yeah, but that's long gone, though. You know,
slavery's long gone too, James. But the vestiges of it are with us to this day. You think people have recovered from the trauma of those commercials, of those ad campaigns? Taco Bell, I haven't.
Oh, right.
Ghetto Taco Bell?
Yeah, see? You're traumatizing me all over again. God bless you.
I'm sorry.
Thanks for the call, James. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Earlier in the week, we were talking about this boorish and sometimes violent behavior by pro-Hamas protesters on college campuses. We talked a bit about the tribal politics that what you see is illustrative of on college campuses. And VDH, Victor Davis Hanson from the Hoover Institution, had a good riff on this tribal politics and folded in a quick commentary on these quote-unquote elite schools, not just the Ivy League, but places like my alma mater that have descended into madness yet again as well.
We've never been in this territory. We have 55 million people who were not born in the United States. That's the highest number in our history and the highest percentage, almost 15% with the latest 10 million. We don't authenticate them. We don't do background checks. We don't even try to integrate and assimilate them. So they are tribal. We say your tribal fides, not your American or your shared residence, is what counts. And then we shouldn't forget this diversity, equity, inclusion. It's really pernicious in two ways. It says that if you're so-called non-white, you can't be discriminatory, you can't be racist, you can't be anti-Semitic, and the world is divided into oppressors and oppressed, and the Israelis and the Jews oppressive white people, and therefore you get a complete pass to say whatever you want. And the second aspect of it is, we don't even have the SAT anymore to go to these elite schools in most cases. And Yale gives 80% A's. The rest of the Ivy League is close behind. These students are not taking rigorous courses. They have plenty of time. They're gut courses. And these universities are intent on racing to the bottom because they're letting in students by their own admission would never have been admitted according to their own standards just 4 or 5 years ago, and now the students are running the university and they determine the grade policy, the types of courses that are offered, and they're in control, and the presidents are terrified of them.
Yeah, and so are the professors, and maybe they should be because everybody else is, and so nobody has their back. For example, just thinking about med schools, although it wasn't a med school course, but it's the course that you need to do well in order to have a realistic shot of being a good doctor. Talking about a couple of years ago, it was Maitland Jones, Professor Maitland Jones at NYU, who had a renowned organic chemistry course that was difficult. Organic chemistry is difficult to begin with, you know, he had a reputation, but he'd been there for a long time, and it was sort of a weed-out class.
Right.
You want to go to med school, you pass Maitland Jones' organic chemistry class, or you do well in it, and you're on your way. You don't, you're probably not, and this is the moment.
Well, you need rules in place for a reason.
Yeah, he got fired.
Why?
The course was too...
Oh,
well,
that's right. It was
we
too
talked
easy.
About it. Course was too tough. Too many people were failing, to Victor Davis Hanson's point. And by the way, where does this come from? Well, it comes from... increasingly, where they go to grade school and high school, even if they're going to, you know, elite private schools that mommy and daddy are paying for, because those elite private schools, just like many of the government schools, have decided to reduce the standards, to dumb it down. There are consultants circumnavigating the country with programs. Good Real Clear Investigations piece this week. Grading for equity. This guy, Joe Feldman, Equity Grading Booster, Crescendo Education Group. He is pitching his wares across the country. Dozens of districts from California and Massachusetts are giving the project a shot as schools face a series of crises, including a spike in chronic absenteeism and sharp academic decline. Grading for equity offers a path to better grades and higher graduation rates. Its practices include the removal of behavior in calculating grades, the end of penalties for late assignments, allowing students to retake exams, and a ban on zeros as the lowest mark. So as we have seen the test, you know, via the test scores, the proficiency in reading and math declined since the school lockdowns. One of the ways to reverse that decline is just make grading more lenient. It's sort of a shortcut, isn't it? But consultant Feldman says the practices he promotes matter of fairness and accuracy in an educational system that's stacked against blacks, Latinos, and other disadvantaged students. Well, yeah, just give everybody the same grade whether or not they can do the work. Well, problem solved. That's one way to go about it. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Dr. Sally Satel, psychiatrist, lecturer at Yale University School of Medicine, and a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Dr. Satel, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I mean, you know, I always reference Stanley Goldfarb because it seems to me he's been the a medical professional who's been writing about this and speaking about it publicly, perhaps the longest, continued dumbing down, not just through grading for equity consultants like Mr. Feldman, that was profiled in the Real Clear Investigations piece, but what we're seeing continue at med schools, too. In fact, you wrote about the Harvard-affiliated med school that's engaged in other bad practices in service of DEI as well.
Yes, yes. This would come under the category, I suppose, of identity politics and medicine. You know, and surgeons and pilots are probably the two classes of people that everyone wants to make sure really know what they're doing. But this specific example has to do with a new policy at Mass General Brigham Hospital, where they were alerted to the fact that Black expectant moms and Black mothers that had just given birth were more likely to be tested for drugs, you know, illicit drugs, cocaine, heroin, and reported to Child Protective Services. You know, and this is very serious business. And the reason this caught their attention was because, not necessarily was this a bad policy, you know, in other words, were we too quick to report? Were we too quick to maybe test without consent? You know, which are things you want to be careful about. And you certainly don't want to scare women away from prenatal care if they think they're going to get reported because they're struggling with a drug problem. But the real problem here is that it was the racial imbalance that was the problem, not the clinical considerations. And so they changed their criterion for testing so that the threshold would be higher. In other words, that the mother and or the fetus slash baby would have to be in imminent distress or suffering injury at the time. And that's probably too high a bar. You don't want to wait till things get that bad. But again, the point is this is a very hard problem. No one has a good answer. All states treat this a little differently. They have different thresholds. Individual hospitals have different thresholds. But you want to find the best policy based on, you know, what's best for patients, again, based on clinical factors, not to even out the scales, because drug testing shouldn't be equally applied across groups. It should be driven by the circumstances of each individual patient.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this is, you know, sort of not exactly on point, but the story out this week about the EEOC going after the Sheetz convenience store chain for doing background checks on prospective employees because they, why do you do a background check of a prospective employee? You want to know if they have a criminal history. Well, disproportionate share of people applying with a criminal history were minorities, so this is some EEOC violation, even though the EEOC does background checks on prospective employees to the EEOC. And so, I mean, it's also sort of the hypocrisy that just sort of rolls downhill, if you will, when it comes to these sort of race-oriented philosophical protocols.
Right. It's what you were saying before, which is if there are differentials in a test, don't have the test, like SAT. And in this case, the test is for drugs. And the thing is, you know, I'm a psychiatrist. I work in a methadone clinic. We have women who are pregnant in the methadone clinic, and not always, but many times the babies need to be detoxed. And hospitals are actually very good at that because they're born with what's called neonatal abstinence syndrome. Basically, their little babies are withdrawing. They're not addicted. That little babies cannot be addicted, but they can go through a very stressful period of withdrawal because they have basically, you know, been bathed in the drug that the mom's taking for, you know, quite a while. But doctors are very good at doing this. The real issue is that then if the mom is still using, and I mean using heavily, that then this little baby has to go home with a mom who's probably not going to be that attentive, probably not going to follow up with you know, postnatal visits and baby checks and all this kind of thing. And that's why Child Protective Services sometimes gets involved. You know, but there's a very high, there should be, and there is in most states, a kind of a high bar for getting Child Protective Services in there. And some states, I say, and I do not agree with this at all, actually criminalize drug use during pregnancy. And that's not the way we want to go. You want to get these women with their little babies into drug treatment programs, usually often residential programs, and those can be just wonderful. They teach parenting. They help mothers get clean. Most moms do not want to have a drug problem, you know, while they have a newborn or while they're pregnant. They don't, but they're lost and they're desperate and they don't know how to stop. And that's the attitude we should have. Not we're going to catch you, but we're going to help you. And I think we could probably be better, we as a profession, maybe a little better at communicating that message, but we shouldn't look the other way, which is you know, a potential problem here with raising the bar so high?
Well, it seems to me there's sort of two buckets here. One is, are we training medical professionals to be experts in their fields? And then two is, are we allowing them to apply their expertise? So the issue of proper reporting that you're describing is applying expertise based on the circumstances. But then this other story out of UCLA is about the training that's occurring or not occurring. And Aaron Sabarium has the piece, and it's about a public health class at UCLA Medical School that seeks to educate, quote unquote, prospective doctors that the problem, you know, obesity is not the problem. Fat phobia is the problem. And weight loss is a Sisyphean task. Don't worry about weight loss. Worry about combating fat phobia, for example.
Oh, yes. I mean, these stories now are rife, and Aaron's doing a great job of documenting them. And I follow them very closely as well. And it's not even the physicians who are teaching physicians. I mean, there's so many problems. And one of them is they bring in these outside, really non-professional advocates, and they're the ones that are teaching the medical students some of these courses, and you know, in intersectionality and implicit bias and concepts. In fact, the implicit bias concept is real, and, which is to say some unconscious attitudes that people carry around all the time. I mean, we all do. The question is, when you test for it, and there is something, sort of a way to that's construed as a measurement of this implicit bias, that it has any kind of predictive value of how you treat, in the case of medicine, how you would treat another patient. And that has been completely dismantled by serious social psychologists and replicated their work that there is no predictive value. So that they're even teaching medical students the wrong, the wrong thing. So that's a huge problem. Another question is, what are they displacing? You know, what are students not learning from true professionals when they invite these, frankly, you know, second-rate mediocrities to expose them to these, you know, social justice jargon? So I worry very much about the quality of training. I've also seen examples where you know, certain conversations can't be had honestly. One example is these health disparities, which are real. There are certainly differences in health outcomes that correlate by race or group, and use of certain therapies that differentials in that. These are all true things. But the first question you ask is, why is that the case? You don't jump to the explanation that it's racism or systemic racism. That's just, at the very least, that's just not scientific. And even if it is, I mean, because when people talk about systemic racism, you know, they talk about, it's a fairly loose concept. And I think, I'm not saying it's not a legitimate concept. When you connect the dots, you know, in other words, folks who, like, let's say Black Americans, sure, they were very incredibly, obscenely disadvantaged decades ago, and there are still reverberations today, you know, from that in socioeconomic terms. That's all true. But then the question is, so what are doctors supposed to do about it? And the answer is not raise the threshold for testing, you know, pregnant women.
Doctor? Go ahead. I appreciate it. But Dr. Sally Satel is a psychiatrist, lecturer at Yale University School of Medicine, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Dr. Satel, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Open mic! Open mic Friday! Call in now! Open mic Friday!
Dan and Amy, yes, it's that time of the week. Open Mic Friday. We take your calls with comments, compliments, criticisms, concerns. General Crack Pottery, we'll take it all. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line, it is Open Mic Friday, brought to you by turnkey.pro. And we start, as we do, with turnkey.pro founder David Kolsak.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city. It's a long, long wait while I'm sitting in committee. But I know I'll be a law someday. At least I hope and pray.
All right, Schoolhouse Rock, David Kolsak's new jam. Yeah.
Well, I asked them to play that because, do you remember those? I mean, do you guys remember that?
When yes,
you
were Saturday
I just
morning.
Sang it verbatim. Yes.
Yeah.
And I will just tell you that I learned the preamble. I think everyone learned the preamble of the Constitution because of those things. But the point that I wanted to play that song is when we were kids, it seemed that the government actually worked to put bills together and made thoughtful decisions about what should happen and how they crafted a law and how difficult it was to get it done. Now bills get through so quickly, you know, it makes your head spin. And they're not just 20 pages long. They're full of billions of spending for other nations and special, you know, projects on spotted owls and obscure pet projects. Also, when we were kids, there was a really high value in patriotism. Remember 4th of July parades? They were huge. It was always American pride and love of country. I mean, that's kind of gone, too. I mean, in my town, we don't even have a parade here anymore. No music festival, no streets lined with American flags. You know, it's really extraordinary what's gone on. And if you fast forward to today, it seems like we need a new song for Schoolhouse Rock, something like I'm Just a Bill, it's 1,100 pages in full, and I'm get right through the whores on the hill. Oh, the congressman can't be bothered to read it right now. I must please my lobbyists and foreign interests in full. And when I do that, I'll make it to law. How I hope and pray that I will get through quickly and fleece all of you. You know, I just made that up, but you see what I'm saying. Congress passes huge bills with billions of dollars faster than a speeding bullet. And as a congressman, you don't even have time to read the whole thing, much less debate it.
I think you should put that. I think you should put that little ditty to music, and maybe you could have like an Oliver Anthony breakout moment.
Well, I used to be a musician, so
I know that's what I'm saying. You know,
bring it back. It's old as new.
Not quite as good as Richmond, North of Richmond, but I think it's you got something there.
No, absolutely not. I mean, that's just a silly thing. But you know, but doesn't it feel, Dan, like we've been taken over by a foreign country? You know, doesn't it feel that way? I mean, it's not just on Capitol Hill, but it's on every part of our country. What happened to Mike Johnson? You know, he vowed to protect the border without a penny going to Ukraine. And now this bill sending billions to Ukraine, Israel and Taiwan. Is he under control? Why would he act that way? You know, doesn't it feel like our representatives are acting on behalf of someone else? When did wanting America first become a bad thing? I was, you know, brought to want a better country for my life, for myself and my countrymen. I remember the bicentennial celebration. I'm sure you do, too. And now so many of our elected officials have dual citizenship. Do you know how many members of Congress possess Israeli passports? I heard it's a pretty high percentage, something in the 80 percentile. Why is that? Couldn't that be a conflict of interest? And what about our courts? Don't they feel controlled by another country? Doesn't it feel like we're living in a banana republic? And did you see the mini Ukrainian flags flying around the House after the House passed the foreign aid bill? If you contrast that with the American flag bearing people on January 6th, you can see who the real insurrectionists are, and it isn't the J6ers. It's disgusting. And what about our borders? In my childhood, I remember it was really hard to gain entry to this country. Now we give migrants cell phones, debit cards, food, shelter, plane tickets. Doesn't that seem like something our enemies would want? You know, I'm Just a Bill has turned into print money and give it to everyone else. Again, it feels like we've been taken over. And I don't want people to become despondent. So I'm wondering if we continue to look the other way and pretend nothing's happened. When is enough going to be enough, and what can we do? How about we start talking about that? What can we, the people, do? And I'm not talking about some sort of armed insurrection or anything like that violent. But aren't we at a Boston Tea Party moment? You know, wasn't that all about taxation without representation? What if we all just stop paying taxes? I'd say vote them all out of office, but I have zero confidence in elections and even less confidence that once they're elected, these people will support the will of the people. Look what's happening. It's a uniparty and really obvious right now. How about making all representatives live and stay in their home states and districts? Why do they need to be in D.C.? They could all vote by Zoom. If they're never allowed to assemble together in D.C. and scheme and cajole, wouldn't the government be more representative? And what about term limits? How about paying the elected officials the median income of their home state? Wouldn't that motivate them to, you know, represent their constituents and incentivize them to raise incomes of those at home?
I also think noncompliance is a really big thing that we should all do. If they tell you to wear a mask, don't do it. 6 feet apart, nope, not going to do it. My point this week is that we've come so far in a very short period of time where America is almost recognizable. It's not clean. It's not enviable. It's not cherished, respected, or assimilated to. It's not like before when my Polish immigrant relatives refused to teach us Polish because they wanted us to be American. I'm still a little salty about that. But it was a different time and a different type of immigrant. Somehow we have to return to the days of Schoolhouse Rock where a bill took time to get through and they thought it through and America was first. So I hope the good guys show up sometime with a plan, you know, a plan we can all participate in that's orderly, commonsensical, legal, peaceful, and most of all effective. I just hope there are some good guys somewhere working behind the scenes because we've got to stop this madness and it's going to take more than one man to stop it. It's going to take all of us.
All right. Thanks, David. Appreciate it. Let's kick off the calls with Ralph in Wilmette.
Guys, good. I missed your call yesterday from wishing me happy birthday, but I thought I'd call you back just to make sure we connected.
What? I'm sorry. You missed our call
to wish you a happy birthday.
I think somebody
wants a birthday.
I see. I'm happy belated birthday, Ralph from Omad.
Happy birthday, Ralph. Yeah.
So much. That's kind of you. Take care.
I think he wanted you to sing it Marilyn Monroe style.
I don't know. Somebody else I know is having a birthday on Monday.
Call him Mr. President when you did that too. Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Always good talking to you. Earlier this week, you offered a discussion on Molly Ringwald and her movies she was in, and saying that the John Hughes movies could not be made today. Let me add to this topic.
Well, I didn't say that. She said that.
She said that.
Yeah.
Okay, let me add to this. What of all the horny teenager movies of the 80s with a largely all-white cast?
You like Porky's, for example?
Yeah, that was my first one. Then there was Mischief. Mischief with Kelly Preston was in that. You know who she is, right?
Yeah,
I do.
Rest in peace.
Yes.
And then My Tutor with Matt Latanzi. I don't know. Do you know who he is?
I'm familiar with the movie, yes.
He was married to Olivia Newton-John.
I did not know that. That's
great
trivia.
Years younger.
Great trivia,
and then,
Bob.
There's several others. And then finally, let me conclude with Risky Business.
Yes.
Oh, I love that.
Bob, how old were you when Risky Business came out, just out of curiosity? You didn't come of age in the 80s, did you?
No.
I
grew up with a lot of these movies in terms of, because they were all set like in the 50s or 60s with kids exploring their virginity or whatever.
Yeah.
Then finally, have a good weekend.
Thanks. Thanks for the call, Bob. I get a little uncomfortable when Bob starts talking about virginity.
Yeah, I know. I don't like
you know?
That.
Yeah. But the Molly Ringwald thing, it was just such an annoying comment. I mean, it's typical coming out of Hollywood, but it's that, you know, the cast were so white and so forth. They weren't diverse enough to be made today, to be remade. And my point was, you know, not every story told will or needs to have universal application. Although John Hughes's films had a lot more application than I think Molly Ringwald understands. I mean, they were about identity, but not in the narrow racial sense that she's obsessed with. They were about belonging to a family, to society. They were about responsibility. And of course we know that great storytelling transcends race, so I wouldn't be surprised if there's some, you know, black kids who came up in the 80s like I did, who took something from John Hughes films, just as I can take something and appreciate John Singleton's Boys in the Hood about growing up in South Central LA in the same time period. So was John Singleton's cast in Boys in the Hood, Cuba Gooding Jr. and Ice Cube, and was that too black? It's just stupid. It's artists against art when you get into this, you know, identity measurement of the cast rather than some assessment of the substance of the story and the storytelling. That's, I guess, the point. Rich in Indian Head Park.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I just have a simple question. Why are women so afraid of saying that men who identify as women shouldn't be in women's sports? I'm not talking about the average woman. I'm talking about, you know, women in authority, like these basketball coaches who have no comment, and you have the Secretary of Education saying they should be allowed as long as they identify as a woman. Why don't they just stand up and say it's women's sports and men should not be allowed to play in them? I don't get it. I don't get why they can't just say that it's women's sports and it's for women only.
Why can't they say it, Amy? Thanks for the call, Rich. Why can't they say it?
Because it's not cool. It's not inclusive. So all these feminists, all these women who fought for Title IX are now, you know, stuck in a little quandrum about what to do. And the fact that, like, as you mentioned, Caitlin Clark, other star, now WNBA players and former college players, aren't talking about it. No one's talking about it. And we did that report yesterday. Was it Spike, right? That went up, they tried to ask all Sweet 16 coaches.
No, it was Outkick.
Outkick, sorry. And none of them, like, not available for comment. Nobody commented. Well, you need to come up with something, because it's not if, it's when it's going to happen. And it can start at Division III, then go to D2, then D1, and then it's going to ruin the WNBA.
Well, as if that's possible. There's two reasons why they don't. One is the Rainbow Reich. Mm-hmm. They don't want the headache. Two is... now, especially, but they all saw it coming. What is the Department of Education going to say about Title IX? They're going to expand it to include gender identity. Mm-hmm. The NCAA has taken a basically, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil posture on it, which Riley Gaines, of course, has been highly critical of, which William Bach resigned from the NCAA board. Of advisors over with respect to fair play, you know, so forth. William Bach, who was the lead investigator in the Lance Armstrong doping scandal. So those coaches say, well, I'm not going to say anything because I don't want to get ahead of the school, and I don't want to be a target of the NCAA, and I don't want to be a target of the DOE, Department of Education. So it's a combination of the government penalties that have now been instituted and the cultural thuggery of the identitarian movement. And also that some of them are also cultural thugs themselves, of course. Some of them are not taking any position because they're supportive and they don't want to draw the rebuke that Dawn Staley, a coach of the South Carolina women's team, drew after she came out before the championship game and said, yeah, if you identify as a woman, you should be able to play women's sports, even if you're a man.
She did so begrudgingly. I mean, she had very dramatic pauses before she answered her question.
Well, whatever. She did it.
Yeah, she did. Do you have anything you want to get off your chest?
Yeah, I want Red in Elmwood Park to speak. Red in Elmwood Park, you're on.
Yeah, I got to tell you. You gotta let Trump go on this immunity, because if he don't have immunity, then Biden don't have immunity, and we can sue Biden to the hilt too in civil court. Everybody that lost a relative due to some of Biden's policies, they got a finger pointing at Trump, but they have three fingers pointing back, as my father used to say.
Okay. All right, Red.
And what about this sex athletic scandal?
Yeah.
Don't anybody remember the East German women?
Yes.
In the Olympics years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Quick people forget, you know?
Yeah, they want their they called and they want their medals back, right? Thanks for the call, Red. That's where we are.
That's no lady.
Georgia Naperville.
Dan, I have breaking news from the mayor's office here in Chicago. He was so moved about a month back with your tribute to the greatest basketball player of all time that he has renamed one of Chicago's airports, and he has taken Amy's contribution in this naming process. And the new name is Peter Midway Maravich Municipal Airport. This is bigger than DuSable Lakeshore Drive.
All right, George. Thanks for the call.
Okay, are you going to let me tell my cat story at some point?
We have plenty of time.
Okay. Let it breathe. Let this sound.
Yeah, let people let the word get around that you've got a compelling cat story so that the light up the phones. You keep people riveted to their seats. Kevin in Ogden Dunes, Indiana. Oh, the Prime Minister.
Prime Minister, get it right, Dan.
You know, the press in Chicago knows nothing about what I'm about to reveal, but there's trouble in paradise, Dan. There may even have been a slow-motion assassination attempt. It was a dark night on January 19th, Governor J.B. Lizzo's birthday. The missus directed me to lead the entourage and the massive security detail to a strip mall on West Belden. All his wife's doing, we didn't know what to think. He was turning 59. Did he want to arrange a bachelor party for his pre-60th or what? But when we got to the address, in the darkness, there was blinking neon signs. Our tattoos last longer than your marriage. So we were at a loss. From the back seat, the governator calls in the wife and says, what's going on? She says, go on in there, JB. It's a birthday present for you. I've arranged for you to get a sexy tattoo on your chest. I chose the artist. Now go in there. They say it won't even hurt much. I myself was thinking I might get one of your second city tattoos, but I quickly decided against it. Rule number one, never take the spotlight off the great man. And number two, in my case, you don't put a bumper sticker on a Lamborghini. So the great man and his entire entourage, they're getting out of the car and entering this parlor. Now, in politics, Amy, size matters. Oh. Big-time politicians, they telegraph their importance with their security details. And also, it ain't easy for the mammoth one to work his way out of a car. Plus, they always leave the cars running. They're burning the premium gas. What a waste. What a great overfed waste. But eventually, he lumbered into the tattoo establishment. He calls out the name the missus gave him, and this fellow, covered from head to toe with all class and color of tattoo, you'd think he was in the NBA. He said he once worked for the water department as a get-out-the-vote man, and he actually paid for the tats with some of your SBA pandemic money and loan. Yes, Governor, we've been expecting you. Take off your shirt. But I bravely stepped forward, Dan, and I said, my good man, please show the governor this lovely art his wife wishes to adorn his gigantic chest. It was then I stopped and screamed. For Dan and Amy, I knew from Ireland's great national healthcare system, the letters DNR stand for Do Not Resuscitate.
All right.
Okay, all right. Oh, my gosh. Thanks for the call, Prime Minister. That was a long walk.
Yeah. To the DNR.
Yeah, that was a long walk. I mean, I think that's original material, so again,
it's kind of how Shameless ended. Yes.
You got to give them some creative bandwidth there. Okay.
His wife has lost a lot. Our first lady, though, of Illinois, has lost a lot of weight. She looks like a different person. Ozempic. It's not only helping Oprah and Gayle King and Kelly Clarkson.
Yeah.
Okay. All the rich and famous are doing it now, Dan.
Well, the Prime Minister does a hell of an MK impersonation, too, by the way. Eduardo, Tampa Bay.
Yeah, the rehearsals this week were great. So now it's time to descend on D.C. for tomorrow's Correspondents' Dinner, because I know you guys threw your passes away, so I want to see those high heels walking down the bicycle paths over there in D.C.
Is the Correspondents' Dinner this weekend?
Yes, it is. Colin.
Yes.
I didn't even know.
Colin Rugg from SNL is the moderator.
Mr. Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah, and she'll be there too, right by his side.
Yeah.
Is Biden going to show up? I mean,
see over under on how long that marriage lasts now.
Oh my gosh.
Well, that'll be a real gala affair, of course.
Pick me. Should I call in?
Dawn in Naperville.
Hi, good morning, everybody, and happy birthday to you, Dan. Hope it's a good one.
Thank you.
Here it begins.
two events coming up still. You guys can get your tickets for the Light to Life banquet that's taking place at Drury Lane on May 10th. So go get your tickets, still available. Also, to the community for adults and children with special needs, the Hope Helping Other People Enjoy.org is hosting their annual prom. So please, you must go register at that website to get your tickets to go. It is Thursday, June 20th at from 5 to 10 over at Bolingbrook Golf Club. So please go get your tickets. And just to follow up in regards to that last segment that you had, on January 31st of 2020, the legal director for COPA posted an article to remind decision makers and the public that the general education classroom under the law is a student with a disability's least restrictive environment. So for those people familiar with the IDEA and IEPs, you're going to understand what I'm talking about. But she did that blog and that article because, unfortunately, many students are seen through the lens of their disability. So, for example, if you have a kid with autism, starting in kindergarten, they get placed into an autism classroom or autism program. And what she's trying to explain is we shouldn't have biases. We shouldn't be assuming that a kid with a disability just can't handle it. So I when I listen to these stories about equity and equality that are being promoted, it boggles my mind, because can we at least provide access to a general education to kids with disabilities? It's just the hypocrisy is really unbelievable. So unless people have tasted the hypocrisy, they don't know. But trust me, there's no equity and equality in our education system, especially if you have kids with disabilities. So, thank you.
Thanks for the call, Dawn. Just because something Dawn said triggered, it's off topic. It's not with respect to kids with disabilities. But I did want to take notice of Dexter Reed's death being ruled a homicide.
Yeah, I know. That made me so mad. He was shot 13 times.
It is a homicide. It's one person or multiple people that killed another person. There's also this thing that's the dictionary definition of homicide, but it's a justified homicide. That's the issue. So, I mean, because homicide is always, of course, referenced with, you know, a illegal murder. Mm-hmm. It's a homicide. Yeah, we know the cop shot and killed him. This is not news. It's justified. That's what the just sort of left out of the conversation. And by the way, I would suggest, I was trying to get this going earlier in this week, people do what I did and post a graduation picture, high school or college, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Post a graduation picture online on social media so Chicago Press Corps can have easy access to it in case you are killed in a police shootout, because it can happen to anybody.
He graduated from high school 8 years ago.
Can happen to anybody. All it takes is, like, you get pulled over for some moving violation, and then you don't comply, and then you open fire on police, and just like that, you can be shot and killed by police. So you want to be remembered fondly, like Dexter Reed was. You want the Dexter Reed treatment. So I'd encourage people to post their graduation pictures online so that the Chicago Press Corps has access.
And remember, he was shot 3 times. He fired 11 shots. And then the whole thing, like Laquan McDonald, that was 16 shots, and then people wrote songs about it and all this stuff. I hope it doesn't get to that.
Matt's aside.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I wanted to point out, not only is food racist, but I think it could be a little bit homophobic. Uh-huh. I mean, let's not forget we got confetti cakes, Skittles, Flamin' Hot Cheetos. And you better not ask anybody if they have a sweet tooth. I'm sure that's going to be considered hate speech. And as far as trans fats go, if you tell somebody to cut out trans fats, then not only are you transphobic, but then I think you might also have some kind of phobia against fat people.
You're trans and fat phobic, right? Exactly. Thanks for the call, Matt. Yeah. Adrian Riverdale.
Yes, sir. And, of course, Amy. Two books. As we're talking about dismemberments. And I recommend The Island of Dr. Moreau,
mm-hmm.
and Geek Love.
What was the second one?
Geek Love, Catherine Dunn.
Geek Love?
I don't know Geek Love. I know
Dan Prost
the Island
story?
Of Dr. Moreau, but Geek Love, okay.
It's Catherine Dunn.
Catherine Dunn, Geek Love, got it.
Writer.
Okay. Thank All right, you. Always like
and
a book recommendation.
One more real quick thing.
All right.
The most despicable term on a planet is Chicagoland.
Oh, I see where you're going with
okay. All right, thanks for the call, Adrian.
Cat story real quick?
Oh, God. I'm just beaten
just
down.
More than that, I wanted to talk about my tweet. I think I authored the best tweet ever.
You pick one. All right, go. Justin, where's animal stories? We have animal stories. Let's do this right.
Do you have it? So that's why I can read my tweet. USC graduation canceled. This is the same class who had their high school graduation canceled due to COVID. A message to the class of 2024: wear sunscreen and vote Republican. Boom.
It's time for Animal Stories with Uncle Dan and Little Amy.
Dan, you and I both love cats, right? Your cat's name was Angel, correct?
I need to introduce you as Little Amy. Before. So now Little Amy, share your cat story.
Okay, take two, go.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
No, go ahead.
So we both love cats, and we know that cats love boxes, right? Because they just love to scratch around in there. Well, this cat named Galena, whose parents live in central Utah, ended up in an Amazon package being returned. They were returning 5 pairs of work boots, so it was a very big box, and Galena somehow got inside and was transported. Ended up 650 miles away from home in a warehouse in California. And a worker was in the trailer, and she heard like this really faint, because they'd been in there.
There it is. Galena? Galena?
It had been in there for 7 days. And thank God it was a big box, so somehow there was oxygen that got in there. But they found this one worker, found the cat, took it to the vet right away. The vet said, he's besides dehydration and some starvation, the cat looks great. And the owners jumped in a plane in Salt Lake City and flew to get the cat, and they've been reunited. Now,
Where did they ship the cat after they were reunited with it again?
Stop it. The cat's beautiful. It's not like a mangy, cat. It's a beautiful cat with blue eyes, and it's Galena's gorgeous. And Justin here, though, who loves cats as well, and he even has his paw of his cat tattooed on his forearm, thinks that they should not be given the cat back. That somebody else should take the cat because they're bad cat owners.
Accents will happen. Yeah, how long did it take before they realized that Galena was missing?
Oh, they knew, the next, later that day that it was missing. Yeah. And we're wondering maybe the cat would come back. And no, the cat.
All right, the cat's fine. I got an animal story.
Okay. Oh.
First of all, the real story is, it's kind of cool. It's kind of a cool story, actually. It's about a seagull.
This little bird.
And a 9-year-old. A 9-year-old who became Seagull Boy. Cooper from England was eating a sandwich. Seagull flew and bit him. And he began screeching in the imitation of seagulls. He wanted to become Seagull Boy, like Peter Parker becoming Spider-Man after being bitten by a spider. So this was his origin story. He got bit by a seagull while eating a sandwich, and he becomes Seagull Boy, and he goes out and he fights crime. Anyway, so that's cute. And then it leads to, there's an annual seagull screeching competition, who most closely can imitate a seagull, in Belgium every year, that I'm sure you're familiar with. And here are the finalists. See if you can pick out who won. Ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
These are all humans.
Okay,
now.
No, yeah, I'm ready.
And it does not include Seagull Boy, Cooper from England.
Right. Ooh, that's good. Santa Monica Pier.
That's two.
Yeah.
Three.
Why not? Is that a fan? No, that sounds.
It's like a rooster.
Seagull on crack. That sounds like a high school senior. That's Sounds like someone under attack.
I think after a few beers, this is already gone, but I hope that gets the message across.
I'm going with number one for sure.
It was the second to last one that won.
Oh, really? Number six?
Yeah. Yeah, the guy with the beer. The guy who said the thing about the beer. Yeah.
Who do you think should have won, Dan?
Seagull comment. You could be in a dolphin competition, right? You do a dolphin?
No, I do turkey.
What?
I
oh, you turkey. Do a turkey, right. What's
That's pretty bad. I didn't really
it's not,
warm
it's not
up.
A great one. Yeah. Steve, Northwest Side.
Hey, Dan, I wanted to thank you for making that, talking about that homicide thing. The news media, in their vendetta against law enforcement, particularly the Chicago Police Department, they do that all the time. Whenever there's an officer-involved shooting, they will always come on the air and say, the Cook County Coroner's Office ruled this a homicide. And they lead the viewer to believe that
right.
the police were wrong.
Right.
Every single time. I've never heard anybody ever talk about that except you today. And I just want to say thank you. Anytime a human being kills another human being for whatever reason, it's automatically a homicide, and you go to the secondary classification, what's the first degree, third degree, or justifiable. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. Chuck and Delavan.
Chuck.
Hey, thanks for mentioning my garage band, Fatophobia. I want to get on what Ralph and
Fat
Bob
Boys
done
cover
today.
Band.
I got to tell you something. There's a big weekend coming up here, and I mean big. It's up in Lake Geneva. It's sponsored by the Geneva Lakes Women's Association. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, they got all kinds of stuff going on. There'll be no shortage of fat chicks up here if you're into that. You guys, want to? I'm going to be getting my signatures for me running for the Senate at the Waukesha Gun Show tomorrow. Very patriotic. So you guys all get out and have a great weekend.
Thank you, Chuck, and you enjoy the lovely, the big, beautiful ladies of Wisconsin.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one, Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.